Hi, Chuck. Welcome to Yachting USA. What a pleasure to be sitting with you today.
Awesome. Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Look where we are. We're in Palm Beach. The Palm Beach Boat Show starts. It's gorgeous South Florida winter weather. Doesn't get better than this.
Amazing.
Tell me about the boat we're sitting on right now.
We are on a 35 Puro Ocean Alexander, which debuted at this show last year. We actually sold hull one. This is hull two. And it's a really good collaboration between Giorgio Cassetta, a well-known Italian designer, and Ocean Alexander, a very well-known Eastern builder out of Kaohsiung, Taiwan.
Yep.
And that collaboration has resulted in a boat that's kind of a new class for Ocean Alexander. And it's really going over well with the clients. The little bit of the European flair with the traditional Ocean Alexander's always been a ship type of a motor's boat that's seaworthy and sturdy, and it's got that and wrapped up in a beautiful package.
I was walking around the boat earlier as we're setting up, and it looks like a very nice family boat. It's got a little bit of everything you need and lots of space. We're taking advantage of the Sun Sky Lounge, actually, to turn it into an impromptu studio today. So
amazing.
Good to have you here with us. This is interesting because you and I, we go back pretty far in the industry. I guess I predate you slightly, but you started with MarineMax in 1992.
I did. So Bill McGill, our founder of MarineMax, we founded MarineMax, formed as a public company in 98. He hired me in 1992. We were basically one store with one brand, and I started selling Sea Ray.
I was going to say, Sea Ray was the brand that everybody knew you guys
about. It really was. I mean, even as a public company for many years, more years than we like, they would still call us the Sea Ray place. And, we've tried so hard to be so much more, but honestly, without a brand like Sea Ray, I don't believe we could have ever brought the dealerships together that we did to become public. So it really, Sea Ray, we have a lot of special place in our heart for that brand. And at the time, it's the greatest brand in the world. Certainly the greatest brand in America.
Yeah, right? No question. They were just amazing. They were built on the East Coast of Florida by and large.
Yeah, that's right.
And with the common ground there too, is I started my business in the back of my dad's shop in Clearwater.
Yeah.
Right on Almerton Road. And I remember if I just went just a little bit west and turned right and came up US 19.
You were on our front door.
There you were. Yeah. And that was some of the first business I did was with MarineMax. And it's so cool to be here in 2025 having this conversation. We have so much behind us to get to this point.
Yeah.
Wow, what a story that is. Let's talk about the Sea Ray story, because that is kind of how everything started. And you guys basically pulled dealerships together to kind of create a consortium of dealers?
We did. It was in a time where there was a lot of companies consolidating and going public, certainly in the auto industry, they were doing that. And our founder got an idea that Bill got an idea that, and the idea, I got to go back one step. The idea was to provide a better experience to the customer. At the end of the day, it really wasn't about let's make more money, let's consolidate. It was let's provide opportunities for the team, which I could tell you sitting here almost 33 years later, it provided me incredible opportunities to others, but it provides a better experience for the customer. And then I'll kind of explain how. But we were basically five Sea Ray dealers, big Sea Ray dealers, but Sea Ray was the common brand thread through it all. And there was enough critical mass at the time. We were somewhere around $220 million. So not a very big company, but at that time, big enough.
Right, right.
And it was just big enough to go public when you think about it. You have to have a big enough company.
That's true.
Sea Ray provided enough business for those companies to form together. And then through the years, we've had a number of acquisitions that all of the dealerships we acquire primarily had Sea Ray as their main brand. And there was other brands that came in and out, but Sea Ray has been a common thread and today is still, if it isn't our largest brand, it still is, one or two. It's right up at the top.
Brunswick never factored into your public move. They strictly stood in as the owner of Sea Ray, and you guys worked independently of each other.
They did.
In with some collaboration, I'm sure.
There was a little bit of collaboration early on where they did get a certain stock grant for allowing us to go public because there's dealer agreements with every dealer. And we needed their permission to have the dealer agreement transfer from what we were, Gulfwind Marine, to MarineMax. So there was a little bit of a partnership there. But no, at the end of the day, Brunswick was a manufacturer. We were a dealer.
Right.
We were, I would say, simply a boat dealer. But at the time, it's pretty much what we were, pretty simply a CRA dealer. And Boston Whaler had entered into it a little bit, but at a lesser scale. Now it's grown to be equivalent with CRA, some years a little bigger, some years a little smaller, but they're two of our biggest brands year
yeah,
in
nice,
and year
nice brand.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. Amazing. It's amazing what they've done through the years. And I think we've helped with that, to be
honest. Of course, you would have to. That the amount of the customer feedback that a company like yours would bring to the table would have to have a lot of influence in how these boats get built.
Yeah.
And what we'll be talking about here and shortly is the fact that you start out selling boats. Eventually, you're evolving into actually building boats. And that's interesting because, you know, I go back so long in watching boat builders in North America and the rise and fall. It's been fascinating, and I'm blessed to have been along for the ride on a lot of these builders. I point to Lazera Yachts, and I was very close to the Lazera family because they were building the Gulfstar line in St. Petersburg,
sure.
And they were my first OEM account.
Great family, great nautical family.
They are, right? And Dick is still a dear friend of mine, as is Brad, and you know, they just lost their son, Richie, but Tony and I are still pretty tight, and you know, it's a cool family. But, you know, we watched what happened when Vince's company, Gulfstar, got basically consumed. Viking took them over, yep. And then as eventually they went away. And I remember the phone call when Dick called me to ask if I'd sit in some design meetings with them because they were going to come out with a new brand called Lazera Yachts.
Yep.
And we integrated davits into the bulwarks of these boats and was very cutting edge at the time. And it's been copied a lot since then, which is a great compliment.
Yeah.
But I watched that brand build and do very well. And then all of a sudden, they overstepped going into the bigger boats, and that hurt them. And then they tried to reinvent themselves, but there was too much competition coming out of Taiwan and coming out of Italy, and they couldn't survive it. And that was that story's repeated itself in this industry a bit.
No, it's a great point. I mean, as a Sea Ray dealer, we went at that time to probably 58 feet was the most relevant boat that we had. They hadn't come up in the L class yet. And then the small Lazera came out, well, I think it was 76. And they built 76. One a little smaller, 68 maybe. And those boats were cutting edge. And we lost so many of our customers to that brand because we didn't have an offering for them. It was phenomenal what they did. And, there weren't a lot of lessons learned, I think, to fall back on for people like that. We've got a great product. We've hit the mark. We're selling a ton. Logically, they think, well, we need to go bigger because our customer's going to go bigger. Well,
yeah.
I don't know that always translates.
No,
funny
no,
enough, when
no.
I look at it, I look at Sea Ray.
And Hatteras is another example. I point out that, you know, they had a pretty good business going in the 70-foot range. The Clorox bottles that people used to talk about, but the long-range cruisers, they did well with that brand. And then they got into the 116, and then they got into the 130. And I'll never forget the Fort Lauderdale Boat Show. They brought their 130 to the show, and they had the misfortune of having it tied to the dock directly behind North Coast's 130, brand new offering that came out of Seattle. And so here are these two boats, identical size. And unfortunately, you could look at the two and see clearly one was a small boat manufacturer trying to build big. And the other one was a boat manufacturer that understood big boat building, had Jack Sirin Naval Architects supporting them. And that was a one and done for Hatteras. That didn't work out so well for them. It's not longitudinal length, it's volume. They become significantly bigger as you go bigger.
You know what that does? And I've seen it. I tell you, this is where when you become a Marine Max, you can get a little bit of influence, and it's really just influence, it's advice, but we've seen it so many times, and we'll talk to some of our manufacturers, that just because you dominate the 50 to 80 doesn't mean you should build 100.
That's right.
And what happens with Hatteras, and we were a Hatteras dealer for many years, love the brand, the intellectual capacity that goes into the workload that goes into building a 130 or a 116 could have been used and allocated to keep the 76 relevant or the 75 relevant or make the 80 relevant or build a 90. And instead, they're building this flagship for all the right reasons in their head.
Right.
But the reality is customers don't come to Hatteras. You know, again, I'll say this with a little bit of review hindsight is 2020. They don't come to them for that size boat. They come to them for a 70 and 80 and 90.
Yes,
and this migration, where if you have patience and you maybe you do sell a dozen 90s, then you've earned the right to sell 100, build 100. But you can't go from 75, 80 to 116, 133. It just doesn't, it doesn't always translate,
right?
That buyer needs to understand, and the builder, let me back up, the builder needs to understand the competitive landscape of building a 133-foot and where that customer is going to go first. And are you going to be able to pull that customer out of that swirl, out of the baits of the other brands, to bite on what you have to offer? And it's not easy.
No, no.
It's not for the faint of heart.
Back when that boat was built, and this is the interesting takeaway when we talk about the decline of yacht building in North America, there were, I've counted over 30 shipyards in North America building over 100 foot. So you had real competition back then that doesn't exist today in North America, but it did then. And there was a lot of choices, and a lot of it came out of the Pacific Northwest. There's a big building market out west that was really doing well.
With some great brands that thrived, and now maybe you're in the, you know, maybe in a period of rediscovery. Certainly some of them don't exist anymore, or they're not active anymore.
Right, right. Most of them don't exist anymore.
You know, and trying to be relevant, example would be, look what Westport did. Their 112, it has to be one of the most iconic boats, over 100 feet in the world, ever built, period.
It's a rock story.
However, you know, what happened with that boat, I think, is it was so successful, they started building other boats instead of saying, you know, how do I keep the 112 relevant in the market that we're playing in today, where we're dominating, absolutely dominating.
Yeah.
You chase a 40-meter, a 50-meter, and that takes all your team's focus goes there. You kind of lose sight. And maybe that's not what happened.
Well, there's a lot of takeaways there. I'm pretty close to that shipyard as well because of the business we did and the relationship I enjoy with Gerald Wakefield. And of course, you've got Schwess that bought the operation.
Yeah.
And there was a decision made to not build on spec, which, when you're in that 112 range, 117 or 125, if you don't have the product, the client's not likely going to wait to get it. And so there was some opportunity missed there. And then this is one of those tough parts of these conversations, Chuck, where we're sitting on an Ocean Alexander. And Ocean Alexander, Horizon, and a couple other brands have definitely taken a huge piece of the Westport market away. And then the questions begged, you know, are we working in a level playing field? Because these are Chinese built boats or Taiwanese built boats. China would like to say that Chinese built boats. Taiwanese would say no.
If some made it Chinese, there'd be a massive tariff on it.
Yeah. There you go. And so I'm not going to go on the record saying I'm pro tariff or not, but I am pro American boater, pro American Yachting USA podcast, after all. And I do want to see in my lifetime, if possible, boat building coming back to the United States. And I'm not sure what that looks like or if even can happen. But I'd like to think there, if there's a will, there's a way. And so, you know, the question is, are we working in a competitive industry where everybody can compete, or are there unfair advantages that exist?
It's a great question. And and I don't know that there's a simple answer. There certainly isn't a short answer. So yes, I believe in America. I think there's no country like ours. If we decide that we collectively, if we decide that we want to build yachts for Americans here, we'll build yachts for Americans. We'll do a phenomenal job. The challenge that I think we run up against is it starts really with workforce. When you go to Italy, and a month ago I was in Italy and I toured 6 shipyards with our group, and we went.
You didn't have to go very far to get to 6 of them, did you?
No, you really didn't. You go to Viareggio, it's the epicenter of yacht building in the world.
It is.
But what I love about that place, what I absolutely love about it, is when you can talk to people on the line that speak English.
Yep.
They're fourth generation
shipbuilders. Yes.
My dad did this. My grandfather did. Yes, they aspire to be that.
Yeah.
And I don't know that the U.S. we're such an interesting place right now that I don't know that if your father was a carpenter, there's something that's getting in the heads of our youth today and maybe in the heads of the parents ahead of them.
Yeah.
That are, I want better for my child. Right. I don't want you to be a carpenter, where if you go over there, I'll let teach you the trade.
Yeah,
I
want it's, you it's to, art, it's art, artistry.
Artesian.
You know, when I was doing business, for instance, with Palmer Johnson and Berger Boat Company up in Manitowoc and Sturgeon Bay, multi-generational, no question, two and three generations, woodworkers, joiner workers, welders, fabricators, electricians, plumbers. And it was really cool because if PJ had a bunch of projects going and Berger was a little slow, they'd pull labor up to Sturgeon Bay to work on these projects and vice versa.
Yeah.
And so there was a community. And if you were in Italy, you probably noticed that walk outside those shipyards, you don't have to go very far to see the shingles hanging outside of little shops that are supplying stainless work, you know, copper work, fiberglass or carbon fiber work. It's everything they need.
Yes.
Is right there. And you go to the Netherlands, the same thing. In the country of the Netherlands, where you have so many, you know, high-end, well-established brands, the infrastructure exists with the labor, the training, the apprenticeship programs, and the subcontractors to support this boat building. So,
even beneath that, the aspiration that somebody, a young person, wants to move into that business because that's what I want to do.
And for the last 3 or 4 years here in the United States, there's been this conversation about forgiving student loans for all these people who've gone to college to get degrees that they can't use for anything and have never been probably vocationally guided.
Yeah. I would say stimulated, right? Just
well, like, you know, you go to high school
you
and
this much being a mechanic.
Well, there you go. You go to high school and you go, well, what are you going to do? What college are you going to go to? What? 20, 30% of the kids are probably really, truly college bound. What about the other 60 or 70% of the kids that are not college bound? There's not a good program for that. It's one of the reasons why I took my son out of high school and homeschooling him, because I realized I can put him in a good direction, whether he wants to go to college or not, better than these government schools can. So yeah, I just got on my soapbox for a minute, but the point is we do need to have, and it's like, I know you and I talked about junior achievement being one of those, the MIASF, REMAX. We're talking to these organizations about telling these kids about vocational opportunities.
Yes. Look, I think it's call it the trades. And maybe it starts with it just a different name, but call it the trades. It offers a tremendous future, great stable income. And when I say stable, you'll do it for the rest of your life.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we need 100 technicians today if we could hire 100. But the problem is you work so hard, maybe you find 30, 40, but we get 20 or 30 of them retire and kind of time out. We're just barely holding serve. And for the good of not only the boat industry, but we'll stay on that because that's what we're talking about, but I mean the home industry too.
Sure, sure.
How are we gonna take care of all these homes and condos and boats that we're building if people can't come and fix a door, can't come and fix an ice maker? And,
AI's not gonna fix this stuff.
No, that's right. That's right. You know, I had an ice maker at the house the other day and they charged a $225 trip charge just to get there. And you gladly pay it because that's what you need to get it fixed.
You want the ice.
Well, that technician's making good money at this point, right? You know, or you hope they are. It's
certainly not.
I know what we pay our technicians. Our top technicians are making tremendous incomes, tremendous stable incomes. And it's good. Being a technician today is getting cleaner and cleaner with all the electronic products, and boats are generally kind of a clean environment anyway.
They need to be. Yep.
It is. It's something that we need to figure out. And I think that it really starts at the parents level because everybody starts out with, got to go to college.
Yeah.
And you think about it, how many billions and billions, if not trillions, but billions for sure, of student debt did we forgive? Those people didn't want to go through that. I mean, forget what your political belief is or whether you should or you shouldn't. These people are living through massive debt, trying to make a better life for themselves, not able to figure it out because you can't even repay
their loans. Stress.
It's no life.
And if they had gone back in time a few years and realized that there was a different path they could take. Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. And, 100%. You know, six-figure incomes if you're sitting in these shipyards welding or you know, running piping and these types of things, you really can make a living wage, stronger living wage.
You can make that, right?
Absolutely.
And then, you know, I think about some of our customer profiles. We have an awful lot of contractor, entrepreneur, developers that if you have that capacity, once you learn the trade from the ground up, then you can grow your business, build a business, and eventually become a customer.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's the beauty of it. A couple rabbit holes here. And I think when we met briefly in Miami a month or so ago, the conversation started around acquisitions and some of my experience. And coming out of that, I realized that your story is more interesting. So I'm not even going to go down that path per se, but I have been paying attention to RE/MAX's acquisitions and what you guys have done. And I'm looking forward to your perspective on all this, because I've watched M&As happening in our industry for the last number of years. And I guess perspective I bring is when I got into the business, this was a cottage industry. These are mom and pop shops, by and large, a lot of passion about building boat or welding two pieces of metal together or whatever that looks like. The money, the income was like the byproduct of doing what they wanted to do because they wanted either a family thing or with a passion that they've got. And so I look at some of the M&As that have been happening and I ask the question, good for the industry, ? Not making a statement one way or another, but do we sterilize the industry with spreadsheets and responsibilities to shareholders? Or is there a way to do this and keep the passion and keep the love and, you know, make it good for everybody?
That's a great question. I would say good for the industry, ! Yeah. There's no easy answer in it. And I promise it'll depend on your vantage point. So passion, you think about our industry, I don't know that you get into the boat industry, into the marine industry, if you don't have passion for it. So start with that. Our founder, Bill, is one of the most passionate guys I've ever met. He was unwavering with his passion, his desire to take care of the customer and provide a unique, just irreplaceable experience. And I think that's translated into the company, right? So I would say I'm a very passionate person, not only for my company, because I am for sure.
Right.
And now I'm trying to stretch out a little bit into the industry, because I think that, you know, one of the gifts that you get when you become our size, even though we're called a micro cap in the world,
right,
in the marine industry, we're pretty big, you know, and having the honor of having a voice, I like that, you know, spread the passion, right? Everything we do is about better customer service, take care of the team, take care of the customer. Everything else takes care of itself. So I'm not a huge spreadsheet guy, although our company, we certainly have solid financials. We have plenty of spreadsheets. We don't run our business off a spreadsheet, right? We have data for sure. And in today's world, if you don't have data, quite honestly, you are going backwards, right? That'll help you make good decisions. But at the end of the day, it's still about the people, still about the passion that those people bring every single day. And, you know, so I think the future of the industry is good because you don't stay in it unless you have some passion. You just won't meet anybody that's in our business that doesn't have passion.
By and large, I totally agree with that.
Right?
Absolutely.
I mean, you'll meet somebody and you're like,
yeah,
I'm going to see you in a couple of years. Smart person, great education, great background, good head on their shoulders, good decision maker. But if you don't have passion, you don't make it.
Right.
Because it's easier ways to go channel all that energy.
Well, you are dealing with people's play toys, you know, and things
they don't. Most thing you'll ever write.
Yeah, nobody needs this, but we're here and it's a continual growing industry. I watched and observed recently a M&A just happen, and it's funny because it, in my world, my perspective, it solved a problem that I thought I was witnessing with all of the marina facility takeovers by Safe Harbor.
Yeah.
And my concern was, and I had a couple of captains come to me. We're talking about putting together a refit roundtable later this year. And they talked about the corruption corridor, they called it. Their words, not mine. But I understand where they're coming from. And it was driven a lot by the lack of choice or by the fact that all these marinas were all of a sudden coming under the same flag and choices were being taken away and services and experiences were being kind of reduced. And then Blackstone comes in. And it's what, a $5.6 billion acquisition?
I believe it is.
That's real.
It's real money.
And what I found interesting is I did some digging and a friend of mine kind of directed my vision to what they did. Blackstone has got two parts of their business. They have a real estate part, and I've always looked at these acquisitions of Safe Harbor as a real estate. And the concern was, you buy all this real estate that will can't be replaced. It's there, and that's all there is.
Yeah.
And you decide one day, okay, it makes more money to stack multi-residents on this property than to bring boats in and work on boats. We start seeing our business model shrinking and our opportunities shrinking. Blackstone came in not with the real estate division, but with the infrastructure division. And so what I'm told is that's a long vision, like port facilities and airports and train rail systems and highways. That gives me a little more optimism that they're looking at their acquisition as a long-term piece and not a flip the real estate deal and make some money tomorrow and out the day after.
You would hope so, right? I mean, what they've acquired are some pretty special properties that look every, you know, we have a lot of waterfront properties, a lot of marinas. Best case use of land would almost always lean into development. We've never bought anything thinking that, you know, hey, if we don't like this in 20 years, let's sell it to a developer. I did understand that the infrastructure aspect of it came with a lower cost of funds.
Oh, is that true?
Which is kind of nice that it takes a little bit of the bite out of $5.6 billion. It's a lot of cash.
That's
You know, alternatively, it's a lot of debt. So,
right.
You know, however that works out for them, I had just heard that. No, it's great, right? I do think capable, stable, proper ownership is better than ownership that is subject to the whims of succession in a family where, I mean, look, a lot of our acquisitions that the patriarch said no. And then the patriarch gets to the end of the road and realizes that maybe the kids don't want to do it or,
right.
You know, in some cases maybe aren't as capable, but the reality is maybe they just
don't want to do it. Didn't have the interest.
Hey, you know,
right.
Now I want to sell my business. It's, you know, that's one of the neat things about our business is it's, when you think about it, it's so generational, but you hope that the next generation steps up. And as they don't, some of these very unique, irreplaceable waterfront facilities come available and it is a nice monetization moment,
no right, question.
For the owner, but now you hope that it falls into the hands of a good steward right. Because slips are hard to find.
Oh, they are.
Really hard to find. Yards are hard to find. Yards are hard to run. It isn't easy. It's not for the faint of heart. And it would be easier to flip it and put up a 50-story building and take that big check, but it doesn't seem to be what they want. And I hope it is.
Me too.
Because we've acquired a fair amount of marinas, and I can tell you, never enters into our conversation. We're looking for stickiness with a customer.
Right.
We want our customer to, you know, buy a boat from us, service with us, and, you know, visit our marinas.
Good segue. You bought IGY.
Yep.
And great marina facilities and cool company. I know a lot of people in the organization. Why don't you take a moment to share with us the thought process behind that acquisition? Because that ties into something we'll talk about here soon, the superyacht division.
Yeah. I would say the seed that germinated into the decision to buy that started in the downturn. So think about what MarineMax has been. We're an accumulation of boat dealers. So we sell boats. When you go through 08 and 09, when boat sales are just, you know, that's your 90% of your revenue comes from selling boats. And then maybe the rest comes from fixing boats. Well, back then nobody was buying, nobody was fixing. It was a really tough time.
It was a light switch. That's what I saw.
It was a big light switch, right?
Yeah, went off.
But we saw dealers around us that owned marinas, had storage, that, hey, people still need to store their boats. So they had a revenue stream coming in. And as we looked at lessons learned coming out of the recession, we said going forward, as we look for dealerships, we were still in the dealership mindset.
Right.
As we look for dealerships, we should look for ones that have marinas because when it in a cyclical business, which it is, we will have better insulation if we have storage. So that's kind of where it started. We started looking at, you know, dealerships that had storage. Well, fast forward it, as Bill moved into the chairman of the board and his son Brett took over, you know, Brett said, look, I want more insulation from just being a boat dealer. Let's get more active and maybe forget a boat dealership with a marina. Let's just look at a marina, which was new for us. But marinas come, they're expensive, but they come, there's a lot of margin in marinas. So it's a good profitable business once you can get past the cost to buy the marina.
The real estate transaction.
$5.6 billion, you got to do a lot of business to pay that back.
Yeah.
But they will do a lot of business to pay that
back. Well, you know the boats are always going to come because there's the one asset resource that's not going to be replaced. There's only 100%. X number of slips available, and there's more. Look at the number of yachts being delivered every year.
Yep.
And the fleet continues to grow, but the marina facilities are not growing to keep up.
That's right. There's no way the slips in the world are growing as quickly as the boats are being built. And then the other boats don't really go away, do they?
Right.
I mean, a 30-year-old boat is still floating out there somewhere. It's still tied up somewhere. And ideally, you don't want to just have a boat sit stagnant in your marina. You want a good customer that's in and out, using mm-hmm. fuel, doing all the
that's
things
right.
that they do. But we've started expanding, and that's where IGY came in. We had done a couple marinas. We realized that, hey, we can do this, and we can do it better. We can do it bigger. And they had accumulated a really nice portfolio of marinas in areas that we couldn't pass it up. So
right.
we chased it and got it, and we're very happy with it. So now, and it'll segue into the super yacht side of our business. So we have these great marinas all over the world, and now we have a super yacht entity that should frequent those marinas. So now you're just staying in touch with a customer.
Well, wherever the customer goes, he's still doing business with your organization.
We love that.
And you have the feedback from him, because when he decides that his boat's a little too big or a little too small, he wants to shift this way or that way, you're already in those conversations.
Which, by the way, every owner either wants to go big or small.
That's right.
They never stay anywhere, right? It's
nope.
either they're, and many times we see it more like the sine curve, right? Where you work your way up and you think, oh my gosh, I got to whatever it is. Your life changes. I still want a boat, but maybe I don't want the big boat. You go to a small boat, then your life changes again. We go back to the big boat. We just want to be part of it.
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
And I suspect that's why Fraser came into the fold, and then shortly thereafter, Northrop & Johnson.
We always wanted to be in that segment. We do like it. It's not, look, being a boat dealer, we have inventory that we have to buy. So we're very asset intensive, right? It's a costly business.
Yeah, yeah.
With lower margin in the brokerage world, the Fraser, Northrop & Johnson world, a customer wants to sell their boat. We're like a real estate agent. So we don't own the boat. We don't maintain it. We don't store it. We don't clean it. We represent it. We sell it. And we take a fee.
That's right.
So it's a nice, clean business.
Yeah.
So we like that. And we had looked forever at a couple of businesses, actually Fraser a couple times, and we were just never able to come to terms on valuation. But what got us over the hump on valuation was we became a company through other brands past Sea Ray. Now we're an asthma, we did Hatteras for a while, and we're a large asthma dealer. Our customer was getting to a certain size, and then they'd leave us.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had the relationship for 15 years, and I can name the names. They bought a Sea Ray, bought an asthma, they bought a bigger asthma. Now they want a bigger boat, but it kind of stopped.
Right.
Where at the time, it stopped where asthma stopped.
Right.
And they're like, we love you guys, but we're going to go buy this, or we're going to go buy that. Or if we were able to sell them the boat, they would call somebody for charter. They would call somebody for yacht management. And finally, it was enough. Enough was enough. We said, we need to be in that. We need to be relevant. And we had tried to grow it organically, because actually, I was sure we could grow it organically. And we didn't, to be honest.
Mm.
And I am sure we could have. It just wouldn't have been in my lifetime. It takes a lot. When you get to meet these people, they're team at Fraser, Northrop & Johnson, they've been at it forever. Passion, their world experience in that arena, I can't train it in 5 years, 10
years.
They've
built the relationships. See, this is a relationship industry.
100%.
And you don't just switch brands or switch. I mean, it's something that is a long-term, long vision. Anybody comes in here with a short vision thinking they're going to just be successful like that.
That's right.
You, by and large, more often than not, are fooling themselves. They're just, it's not happening. So you were right. You, by picking up a legacy brand like Fraser or Northrop & Johnson, you didn't just get the brand. You got the brokers, you got the history, you got the clients, you got the reputation,
right.
You got the culture.
That's right. And we were, look, at the time we knew what we were doing. It's, if you lose the brokers, the vast majority of what you bought walks away. So it was, we were very thankful that we had a great transition in. We were able to retain all the brokers that we wanted to retain. We've tried, you know, and we still today, we try to provide them best-in-class tools that maybe if you were just standalone, you couldn't have these tools. We're working on things right now, which we're so close to launching. It's super exciting. Customer IQ and Yacht IQ are two in-house proprietary tools that we've developed that will help you with customer analytics, customer behavior, customers' engagement with various websites. And then Yacht IQ is all the intelligence around the yachts that our brokers will have on their fingertips.
Wow.
That no standalone company could build. But when you combine a couple with the backing of MarineMax, we can afford to invest in that technology because we can spread it out over 10,000 boats.
Right, right, right.
Between our new boats and our used in brokerage.
Right? Something that's coming out soon?
Yeah, very soon, very soon. Cool. So we're Customer IQ. We've launched it in certain segments. Yacht IQ, we've launched it in certain. It's not universally launched because you want to be careful with something like this. You
don't sure.
You want to pull a lever that doesn't work. But we're past the beta testing. We're now real world testing it at a couple locations. You know, in our, call it 70 rooftops, we have stores that are technologically more advanced than others. So the ones that are the early adopters of technology.
Right. They're kind of beta testing this for you guys.
They're getting it out. And I would say we're 60 days in customer and 6 months on Yacht IQ. And
wow.
It'll be super exciting for our team to have a benefit.
Of course.
Because it's what it's all about.
You need to find that edge.
It's never, and I've said it so many times, and I promise I believe it. It's not about being the biggest by any stretch. You have to be the best, or all you are is the biggest.
Yeah.
I mean, so many companies that were the biggest of everything have failed because they weren't the best.
Right.
So
right.
We want to be the best.
It's reinvention.
Size will take care of itself.
Yeah, reinvention. It's, you can't sit on your hands. You've got to innovate and listen to what the client wants and be able to, you know, provide. Or in this case, your people, you know, give them 100%. The tools they need to do the best job they can do for you. This is a great segue into the fact that you did create a super yacht division. And I've always been curious about this because in my career, found that I needed to be in the super yacht world because that's what I could. We never were good at making 100 widgets. We were really good at making one or two really freaking great machines, well-engineered and integrated with a really cool yacht designer, a really cool yacht builder. And that's the large yacht marketplace. And that's where I cut my teeth. And it's a completely different animal than when you see the production builders, you know, like the Sea Rays and the Boston Whalers and all
sure
that.
Sure it is.
Flip that over now. You're coming out of production building. You're coming into the big boat market. What's that learning curve like? And what's that to a company like MarineMax who's going to now enter into the big boats and fully immerse yourself in the large yacht industry?
Well, the learning curve, first of all, we didn't know what we didn't know. You know, we believe certain things, you know, I always say we don't know a lot about it, but we're quick learners.
The voice of a wise man who says he doesn't know what he doesn't know.
That's right. No, we didn't. You know, we had assumptions and you got to keep your eyes and ears open, but by acquiring great companies, we didn't have to learn. You know, we didn't have to be in the fire to learn. We just had to watch what they were doing and learn from them as quickly as we could. In fact, when we purchased Fraser, wasn't very long after Northrop & Johnson called us and said, hey, we see you guys acquiring a bunch and we'd be interested in talking to you. And we said, listen, we don't even know what we've got. We know we've got a good company. We want to learn this business. But before we get more deeply in it, we just give us some time to understand what we are entering into. Taking that, look, we don't know what we don't know approach. We know we like the space. We know that you look at it, you want to be part of it, right? The business is real. We like the 360 view of it between yacht management, crew placement, charter management, charter retail, the whole thing. We've got it all. We didn't need it any bigger, but they talked their way into the room, to be honest with you, because we knew one of the gentlemen on their team who used to work for us. We're like, all right, come on up. We'll meet. Can't hurt anything.
Right, right.
We kind of fell in love with their team. And then it was...
It's people business.
It is a people business. We know.
Right.
And we thought, these are people that can be additive. And I would tell you, honestly, at first thought, we're like, this will be cool. We'll combine the two companies. We'll be the biggest super yacht provider in the world by every definition. And, you know, now we're the biggest. But as we got to know that both companies, in a little to some degree, both customer bases, the people went to those two companies for two different reasons. And the brokers that go to work there, the team that goes to work there, they were two different companies. So we chose, very liberally chose, to leave them independent. Frazier will be Frazier, Northrop & Johnson will be Northrop & Johnson. We'll build a back end that's invisible to the customer.
Right, right.
That'll have the benefits. Right. You don't need HR at both places. Right. You don't need IT, website development. Right. You know, all of that can come back.
Right. And of course, you've got Fairport Global in the middle of this to supply yacht management services and yacht support oversight, I would imagine.
Well, as an independent, kind of independent to Frazier that has that. They came with IGY, funny enough.
That's right.
We had talked to them. We were going to bolt it on to Northrop & Johnson, but unbeknownst to us, at the same time, they were talking to IGY, and they went the IGY direction. It was disappointing at the moment, but that's life. You don't get every acquisition that you chase.
It came full circle.
It is funny how that happens.
Yeah.
But the super yacht side is amazing.
Yep.
We love being in it. We're very comfortable with what we have right now. I believe, although I would have said the same thing when we acquired Frazier, our growth can be organic. We have all the tools now, all the capabilities. We can keep growing in the space. I think we'll grow. If we grow, we'll grow. And we're not chasing the next one to say, all right, I need another store in there. Right. We have enough critical mass to be relevant.
So I'm going to put you on the spot just a little bit, because I'm going back to this whole idea about building in the United States, and RE/MAX is a large $2.4. Okay, that's real.
Yeah.
If you had a consortium or group of owners or industry professionals who wanted to start a boat building business in the United States, what would that look like? How can you combine the power of RE/MAX with the ability to do something here rather than chase the customers across the pond?
Well, that's a great question, because we are a manufacturer in the United States.
Yes.
Right. We acquired Cruiser Yachts and we acquired Intrepid. And, to kind of set the scale, those two companies build about 300 boats a year. In new boats, we sell about 5,000. So it's not people are like, oh my gosh, you're going to vertically integrate.
No.
Well, no, I need 4,700 more boats to vertically integrate. We're not even close. We don't want to.
Right.
Both of those had a unique story behind it. We're happy to be in it. But I will tell you that my DNA, I know how to sell them a lot more than we know how to build them.
Right.
And we have the greatest people that are running those companies that are helping us build them. But manufacturing is it's tough.
Well, so what would I say?
I don't know what I'd say.
Okay.
I'd say if you build a really good one, I'd like to be your dealer. I don't know that I would,
From my perspective, Chuck, it's going to take the brokerage community to have a little bit of influence into working with a high net worth individual to say, hey, yeah, I can take you to Holland, or I can take you to Italy, or wherever we can get you the boat.
Yeah.
It's safe. I'll get my commission and you'll get your boat in a period. It's going to take that high net worth guy to say, yeah, but I really want an American built boat, and a right broker to say, yeah, well, here's how we can get this done and map it out. Because, well-known, maybe not so well-known secret, margins in building boats, really small.
The margins in selling boats too, right? There's a lot of, and it's not the margin. And I'll say this, it's not the margin, it's the costs, which ultimately the gross margin is not bad. But it's just very expensive to realize that gross margin. So at the end of the day, your net profit bottom is probably slimmer than you would like.
You don't have to have too many hiccups to all of a sudden see that bottom line really become stressed.
No, it really is. And if you make a mistake as a builder, just think about a warranty claim on a boat. Mm-hmm. If God forbid you make a big mistake, it's catastrophic.
Yeah.
Honestly, I believe it's why Sea Ray's out of the yachts. They were the number one yacht manufacturer in the United States. But they built some complicated yachts that they didn't make enough money. And then they had some warranty on it. And they're like, we're out of this.
Yeah, it's too much.
We don't need this.
Well, like I said at the beginning of this conversation, I got in this business. There was over 45 builders in North America. Yeah. List five or six left, So that's a lot of bad stories are repeated, because really at the end of the day, a lot of effort with not a lot of, you know, profit coming back from that.
No, I will tell you the timeliness of this conversation. You could add a word to it that could be a influencer in the future, and that'd be tariff. So
yes,
if tariff boats, that could do exactly what tariffs are supposed to do. It mm-hmm. brings production back to the United States. I don't know if that's going to happen. I can tell you this, though. We talked to a lot of European manufacturers, and they're talking more now about maybe putting a footprint in the United States, because look, in the global scheme of boating, the U.S. is very important. I mean, it's about a third of the yachts sold in the world come to U.S. owners anyway. So that's a big segment. You can't ignore it.
Right. Well, and I'll tell you, in the large yacht industry, I did an interview last year with Farouk Fetty with FedShip, and then another one with Rose Dahman at the Superyacht Forum. Rose shared with me that 74% of the support vessels and the AMLs that are building right now are American clients. Yeah. And Farouk said that was 65% of the FedShip sold are to American clients. That's a significant number of U.S. clients building the large and very large boats.
Yeah.
You know, so, and then you look what Bill Gates just built there at FedShip at the Van Lent facility, with Breakthrough, one of the first hydrogen.
Beautiful boat,
by the way.
Spectacular boat.
And, I say that with any criticism, because you're not going to get that kind of technology without the cooperation of the owner and the shipyard and the technology providers. And I understand that Mr. Gates sequestered a number of millions of dollars specifically to fund the research to bring hydrogen power.
Yeah, that's a very unique, right? You got the right owner and the right builder and a right partner in the hydrogen company that's going to help them figure out how to make it all work. That's pretty special, right?
Yeah, that's how the technology comes into our industry. So people that come to me in the past and criticize large yachts and the high net worth people that buy these boats and build these boats, I point to the technologies that are on these boats here and the boats that you're selling in production right now and say a lot of that started because somebody decided they're going to invest in that idea and develop it in the larger boat. And then once it's perfected, it does find its way down into the smaller boats.
You know, it's funny. There's the prevailing wind of, social outreach for a big white yacht, right? Nobody ever feels sorry for a yacht owner, nor should they. But some of the disdain that they look at these boats at, I wish they knew, like the boat we're sitting on will keep 75 people busy 40 hours a week for a year and a half. That's how many labor hours go into something like this. And it's not, it's a nice boat, but it's not huge.
So out of the mud. It's just.
It employs, and these are people, by the way, that weren't, it'll go back to Italy. You're a third generation yacht painter. Where are you going to go work if they don't build yachts? You're not going to paint houses.
No.
I mean, these people are craftsmen.
Right.
No. So, the world is fed in some cases by tradespeople. And they build boats. They build yachts.
And it's not a bad thing at all.
There's very
little robotics go into building a yacht. So much of it is hand fabricated, hand done, hand finished.
That's right.
And it's a gift that keeps on giving too, Chuck, because after you've delivered it, after it's gone through its warranty period, after the owner's taken delivery and he's hired the crew.
That's right.
And he's got the crew on board and he's got all that payroll going on and everything that goes along with that and says, now we're going to go use the boat. He goes to an IGY marina and he plugs in. And he's paying docking fees and he's paying for the power and his crew's going off to the local markets, buying goods.
100%.
And it's
guests are going to the restaurants.
Absolutely. Yeah, and they're hiring the local tourist boats. And it's a economic machine that moves around the world. And every place it stops, it deposits cash.
It does.
There's no better way, essentially, to trickle down wealth from the high net worth individuals into our communities than these white boats.
I agree with it. It's a shame that there is a little bit of the, use the word again, wealth shaming going on. Environmentally, these people care about it. Philanthropically, they probably do more for the waters, for clean waters, than 100 random people. They really do care about the environment.
It's interesting you bring that up, because as we close this conversation here soon, I point out that I have been supportive and work with the International Seakeeper Society. Wonderful organization.
Great organization.
And one of the things that they do, and one of the things I help to facilitate whenever and wherever I can, is to bring scientists and universities to these yacht owners. These owners are taking these beautiful vessels to the far reaches of the world. And when these owners understand that they have the opportunity to accommodate and bring on scientists or students that are doing the thesis or their final works towards their degree program, they love that idea. They love the idea of accommodating this and bringing people to a place that otherwise they couldn't afford to get to, doing research on the oceans that needs to be done, that the private sector has got to participate in if we're going to, really scale it.
Yeah.
And so, again, when you look around this venue we're in right now with all these yachts surrounding us at the Palm Beach Boat Show and realize that there's so many ways that this industry can give back and support, I think it's a shame that we don't do a better job expressing the benefits that we do bring to our society through this distribution of wealth and this love we have of boating and yachting.
Well, that would be a great segue to a finish for sure. And I'll just add to it, you look back to Steve Jobs was a great boat owner Paul Allen.
Paul Allen, yeah.
Paul Allen. His fleet and what he did for worldwide environmental research by donating his boats out there.
Yeah.
He couldn't have done it. Because he had boats, he had the appetite to do it.
Right.
Where I'm going to put you on a $40 million vessel. You're going to go out and do the far remotes and you're going to, take it for a month or two, do your research, and then come back. Amazing.
Yeah. His boat Octopus with that built-in submarine pen and the way he utilized that, John Pinder White's program that he was working with Paul Allen was just so powerful. And he's just one of many. I mean,
that's right.
There are others that, Gene Machine that's here at the show, they do some similar things. They get their boat out there and they do a bunch of research and they create a platform for others.
I just saw, and I think you were in the same forum at Superyacht Forum in Amsterdam, where they talked about the number one growing segment in yachts right now is expedition yachts.
That's right.
They're growing faster than anything, which really, to me, kind of warms my heart that, these are people that are trying to get away from marinas. They're trying to get out there and be self-contained, and they're looking for ways to get out and connect with the environment in its most natural form. So
COVID did that for us.
Yeah,
it turned on a lot of people to the opportunities of being on the water and away from people and being a little self-contained and all that, which is good. And of course, it was something you and I also have in common in our family boating. I've got a small 30-foot boat that I enjoy and I love and I use, and it's wonderful to take the family and do things with them. I know you're a family boater as well.
Very much so.
I think that's, at the end of the day, probably the most important part of this whole conversation is the fact that what's more important than family and what's more important than bringing our loved ones together and sharing a love of the ocean and the ability to be present.
I agree with that.
You're not on cell phones or gaming devices and, you're together on the ocean. And I think that's one of the most wonderful ways this industry pays us back.
It's a blessing if you can grow up that way. I mean, I grew up on a 16-foot boat with a 65-horsepower engine that I'm telling you, it's as modest as a boat could be. But when you're on the water looking back at the shore, the view is the same as if you were on the back of a yacht, right?
Almost sounds like a Donzi Sweet 16.
It was a scat craft. A tri-hull scat craft.
Oh, wow.
And it was just modest. I mean, it's smaller than most tenders anymore.
Right.
But I didn't know that, right? I mean, I just knew I grew up.
You were on the
water. I just grew up on the water.
And like you said, the view is the same.
The view is the same. Now the amenities on the other side are all different, but I grew up a boater. And I have no doubt that early interaction with the water and that lifestyle, even though it was modest, is why I'm here.
Right.
At some point, something inside says I want to get up and go to work every single day in the boat industry.
Well, I've got to tell you, Chuck, I've really admired over the last three decades what MarineMax has done. It's been interesting seeing it from a distance, not directly connected to it, but aware. And I just have to say, you should be very pleased and proud of what you guys have accomplished, because it's not easy. No, it's a tough, that's a tough assignment.
But we have to say, there's like, from a money standpoint, there's a lot of easier ways you can make money. But we're all passionate about boating. We really are. I mean, at the end of the day, we sit and we're like, take care of the customer, take care of the team, and everything else kind of takes care of itself. And it seems simple, but it works. And, you know, part of the team, we've learned, we used to hire really, not that we don't now, but we used to hire really smart people, and we'll teach them about boating. You've got to love the water to be in our business. You've got to love the water. So anymore we talk about, you know, today what's kind of cool is you can go to somebody's Instagram and say, if there's no water in your background, you're not for us.
Hey,
I mean, it's
think about it.
It really is. I hate to say it. It's about that simple.
Well,
at least for step one.
Well, no, that's real.
You have a whole bunch of other qualifications, but let's just start with, what do you look like in your life? And you go there and like, you go to mine, probably only have 15 pictures, and I'm telling you, 13 of them have water in the background.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't take a minute to figure out, wow, this guy likes to boat.
Now that's
and
that.
And then you can transfer it.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. I love this. Well, Chuck, this has been a real pleasure. I look forward to sometime in the near future crossing paths again, having more conversations.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you guys have got some exciting things coming up. I will, you know, love to hear more about it as that comes together.
Yeah.
And yeah, let's keep this conversation going, because again, I think we're in alignment with what we want. We want things good for our industry. We want things good for our own business here in the United States, recognizing it's a world industry and that we do business around the world.
Yeah.
We welcome the business from around the world.
I'll tell you, you know, I'll leave you with this. Bill told me a couple of days into my career, all boats rise with the tide.
Yes.
And it was hard. It took me years for me to really believe what he said, that because you wanted to, you know, step on the throat of your competitors and you want to win, win, win. At the end of the day, the more we can do for the boating community, we'll get our share.
Oh, yeah.
I don't need to worry about that.
No, I use that same analogy, you know, rising tide
floats all boats.
And, you know, it's really not about winning. It's a process of getting to where you want to go.
That's all it is.
And I am thrilled to be here with you today. Yeah. I hope you have a fantastic week here in Palm Beach.
Likewise.
And, this is going to be a crazy week. I love it. Thrive on this kind of thing.
Us too.
And look forward to the future.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chuck.
All right.
It's been a pleasure. Until the next time, I'm out of here.